the Star Wars Report podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're very excited about tonight's show. We've got a very special guest, as we're going to be talking about, well, that book that Riley keeps ranting and raving on about. It's How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. I'm super excited for today's show. Let's do it right now.
Falcon Flight with Destiny.
Millennium Falcons fly with Destiny. That's at least how we call it here at the Star Wars Report podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in the brand new year here. It's 2016, a year of yet another Star Wars movie release, Rogue One, coming up. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Chris Taylor. How's it going, Chris? Welcome to the show.
It's going great. Thanks for having me, Riley.
I'm so excited to have you on. And I have no idea if you remember any of this, which is why I said none of it before I just started the show with you on Skype. And that is your incredible book, which everyone on this podcast has heard me going on and on about how amazing it is. I have bought many copies of it and shelled it out to unsuspecting Christmas gift recipients. But there's a funny story about your incredible book, and that is back at Star Wars Celebration, Celebration Anaheim this past, I guess last year now, I had the pleasure of going to this kind of big podcaster get together at the bottom of the Hilton Hotel, and who do I hear but this familiar, sophisticated British voice in the background that I recognize from the awesome Full of Sith podcast. And I'm like, oh, it's Chris Taylor. He wrote that book that I haven't read yet. And so I walked up to you and I'm nothing if not honest, sir. And I said, wow, I've really liked your appearances on Full of Sith and I follow you on Twitter. I really like what you've had to say about Star Wars. Haven't had a chance to read the book yet or anything. And doggone it, if you don't just do the nicest thing and you actually signed and gave me a copy right there, like all good authors do, you had a, you were like carrying copies of your book right there with you, which is just awesome.
I think that was the one of the few times I did actually have a spare copy. So you were just fortuitous enough to be in the right place at the right time.
There we go.
Yeah, that was a great evening there with the podcast gathering.
No, it was absolutely. But the story doesn't end there. It takes a dark turn, not unlike the original trilogy. Mm. I have a lot of siblings, Chris, and I'm gonna as I do as the youngest sibling of the six of us, I'm gonna lay the blame on somebody else.
Of course.
And that is to say that I right now have in my proud possession the jacket of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, but I do not have the actual hardback copy. And so I lent it out over the summer to, I have no idea who. Now, Grant, you could say, like, if my siblings were here to defend themselves, which they're not, they would say that I have a terrible pattern of misplacing items. But I would say, since you're not here to defend yourself, ghost of Riley siblings, I'm just going to lay the blame on you. But that being said, I did eventually, after being chastised by a friend of the show, Justin Robert Young, from, of course, the Weird Things podcast and Night Attack. He's like, all right, dude, it's time. So in the week leading into The Force Awakens, I gobbled that thing up on audiobook, and it was just a fantastic ride. And folks have heard me say it before, but I feel like my condensed version of why I love this book is it is a thorough, complete, and fun telling that threads together multiple factors that have really led to this cultural phenomenon that is Star Wars. And it puts it in a kind of perspective that as someone who podcasts about it every week kind of tends to individualize and compartmentalize the impact. So it really kind of, I think, helped, for lack of a better term, just to explain why we're all here talking about Star Wars.
Indeed, yeah. It really is the first book to sort of pull back and give you the whole picture. which I was surprised to discover no one had actually done before. But it's kind of like, you know, it's like a fish trying to write about water. I mean, Star Wars surrounds us, penetrates us, binds us together, and it's really, you know, we sort of know all this stuff in a way, or we know some of this stuff, but it's, you know, seeing it all together in one place, tying the narrative together, talking about both the fans and the creation itself. Yeah, you know, it produces a different kind of feeling when you read it all in one place.
That is amazing. Yeah, and I wanted to get into a few specific things that kind of stuck with me from the book as well, and then we'll just kind of see where the conversation takes us. But let's just start with what was the genesis for this project? When did you decide that this was a book the world needed?
Well, I tell the story a lot, but there were really two genesis, beginnings. Let's go with that.
There you go.
Firstly, the discovery that one of our writers at Mashable, which is where I work, and I'm the deputy editor, had not seen a single Star Wars movie was quite exciting for us. This was about 2011, I think. And so we sat her down. We made her live blog her watching of the original movie. And it was the fact that it wasn't, you know, we didn't get the sort of 1977 vibe that we were looking for. That kind of, oh, wow, this is all so fresh and original and new reaction. Instead, you know, Christine, who's a lovely soul, recognized so much of it. And you know, so much of it was familiar, not just the sort of movie language that Star Wars created that has been imitated many times since, but also, you know, the content, the characters, the plot twists. It was all familiar to her, and she hadn't seen a single minute of Star Wars. So that started me thinking, can we find anyone who is not familiar with any of Star Wars? And, you know, so that was one project going along. And then the realization, as I say, you know, that there had been no one single history of the entire franchise that wrapped it all up, with a Nepo and talked about everything. You know, that realization came along when I wrote an opinion piece in October 2012, right when Lucasfilm was sold to Disney. And the opinion piece did very well, got picked up by the official Star Wars page and Facebook page. And, you know, it was very widely distributed. It was one of the first pieces to say, hey, actually, you know, guys, Disney's going to be a good steward of the franchise.
I remember that piece.
Yes. And that was so popular that, you know, a book agent I'd been working with got in touch and said, well, hey, maybe there's a book here. Has anyone written a book about, you know, Star Wars, the entire history of Star Wars? I was like, of course they've done it. And then I looked into it. And of course we had, Skywalking, the first biography of George Lucas. We had, the book that was previously called Mythmaker, and then I think just became called George Lucas, a biography. We had, of course, Michael Kaminsky wrote The Secret History of Star Wars, which is sort of less, it's kind of less on the radar for a lot of people, not a mainstream book, but, you know, that did a good job of sort of telling the narrative of how George was flying by the seat of his pants a lot when he wrote it. You know, Michael, you know, I got in touch with him. I talked to him. He's a very good guy and very, great researcher. He dug up a lot of stuff and told an interesting narrative. But that wasn't really the whole story, because you have to talk about how Star Wars affected the world, how it conquered our cultural universe, as well as just the George Lucas story. So no one had done that. And, you know, so I saw that opening, and obviously there was a lot of interest in that from publishers. And I was sort of celebrating for about 5 minutes, saying, wow, you know, no one else has done this, and I'm going to get to do this. And then after those 5 minutes, you know, the sort of very heavy burden of responsibility kicked in. That sort of feeling of, oh, if I get this wrong, there will be hell to pay. you know, the fans will not forgive me. I've got to do justice to this. And so, yeah, it was a 2-year labor of love, and, not a whole lot of sleeping went down in those 2 years. And, at the end of it, I mean, you know, that's really, I wrote so much more that is contained in the book. And I think I wrote on the first pass about 160,000 words. and I had to lose about 40,000 of those. Oh, it was really a ruthless process.
Oh, no. No. When is the special edition coming out?
Well, as we know, as you know, some of us feel about the special editions, you know, you put extraneous material in, it does kind of slow it down. So I really, you know, my goal throughout was just to answer the question posed by the title. How did Star Wars conquer the universe? And there were many areas of that where I wanted to get into it deeper, but I really wanted this to be just a one volume survey that answered every possible answer to that question. You know, every possible reason that you couldn't think of has to be contained in here somewhere. So hopefully that's what I've done.
I know. And what kind of surprised me is that, Chris, I'm from a generation that, I'm 24, mm-hmm. and I'm from a generation that is, grew up with the prequels. And right. I wasn't even really kind of aware of Star Wars in terms of the online fandom until maybe around 2008, 2009, really. Mm-hmm. Me and my friends back in high school around the time Revenge of the Sith were hanging out and talking about it and, reenacting scenes from the films with our lightsabers and inventing complex, role-playing games and LARPing mm-hmm. before we knew what it was, what LARPing was. You know, we were doing all of that, but, by the time I was kind of aware of a lot of what you talk about in the book, the different aspects of Star Wars, like the 501st, like the R2 builders, when you touch on these cultural elements of the fandom, I kind of was of a mind and of a, I guess of an impression that Star Wars had kind of always been that way. It's like, oh, well, they were always, you know, 501st has been around forever. I didn't realize that, like, at the time I was getting into, you know, the early days of Star Wars blogging and podcasting and discovering friends on the internet, right? When that was becoming a thing you could do, I kind of assumed that, like, oh yeah, the 501st, they've always been around doing stuff. Little did I know that, like, your book kind of gave me some perspective on, like, that stuff really only started in the genesis of the prequel era. It wasn't like that. It's, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's this sort of underground passion that's always been there that only in the recent, say, 10 to 15 years has really fully exploded. That's kind of what your book had me, when I closed the proverbial audiobook pages, right? That's kind of what it left me with.
Yeah. And I sort of, you know, this is one of the most surprising things that I came away with, that so much of what we associate with Star Wars, so much of fandom, so much of merchandising, came from, you know, after 1997, after the special editions came out. That seems to be, have been the starting gun for a lot of what we now consider to be Star Wars fandom. It was certainly the beginnings of the 501st, which, by the way, would not have existed without the internet. And same with the R2 Builders Club. That was sort of sparked by the special editions, by the re-releasing. And really picked up steam around about the prequels. So, you know, you really touched on, you know, a couple of the main reasons why we have the fandom the way that it exists today. You know, number one, the internet, and number two, the special editions and the prequels. It really, you know, I mean, that the majority of action figures came out after 1997, if you do a, you know, straight mathematical analysis. And it's funny because we remember 1977, and we, you know, we tell the story about the long lines, and we talk about what a big impact Star Wars made on movie making, and it became a cultural phenomenon. But that really wasn't the whole story, and I don't think that it would be remembered the way it is today, and it wouldn't have the impact that it has today without that sort of second wave.
Yes.
And if you like, a third wave with the prequels as well, and the kind of fandom that you're talking about, that, you know, that you're part of, that emerged in 2007 onwards, I would say, the social media fandom.
Yes.
You know, I think Star Wars fandom really takes off with Twitter, with Facebook, and with the fact that it's so easy for, you know, isolated nerds, for want of a better term, who are in, you know, communities that don't necessarily share their passions, to go online and realize, oh, well, actually, it sort of feels like I'm in the majority here.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that I discovered. That's really very much my story. And it's interesting because when you talk about it, I think a good example is Growing up, a lot of the cherished stories that I grew up with, I hold in equal value. In fact, like the mythology behind Tolkien's Middle Earth is something that, has captured my heart and soul in a way as a young teen that, Star Wars never did. It's very different. And the same thing with, a few years earlier when I first read the Chronicles of Narnia. And there are these amazing mythologies that, you know, that I think have influenced us so much, but there is something very special about the communal aspect of Star Wars fandom that really only has given rise. It seemed, at least, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed like somewhat dormant until the age of the internet. And could you talk a little bit about why you think that is? What is it about Star Wars that really, influences that communal aspect of the fan community?
I think it's because it's so widespread in our culture. You say Star Wars, everyone knows what you're talking about. And it's also so easy to get in. I mean, this is the other big revelation that came through writing the book, is that Star Wars fandom is so accepting and so open, and I would venture to say more so than any other fandom out there. I'm not a huge Trekkie, but my understanding is that there's no sort of, you know, you kind of have to know the canon of Star Trek. You kind of have to have seen quite a bit of it, at least the entire original series, which is, what, how many hours of viewing? Mm-hmm. Or maybe you're a TNG fan and you have to watch it, at least a couple of seasons of that. With Star Wars, all you need to do to be part of this fandom is to have watched the original two-hour movie. You know, it's just 2 hours of your life, and most of us have done it already. We may need a refresher, but as long as you've seen that movie, you're in. You know, you can go to Celebration and hold your head up high with everyone else. There are people who, there are the old timers who feel, you know, some of them feel, I know many 501st members who feel that there are only just two Star Wars movies, right? You know, they don't even acknowledge the existence of Return of the Jedi. I'm going to have to go back to those guys and see if they acknowledge The Force Awakens as a third movie, you know. But that's fine. They can still go trooping. They can go trooping alongside clone troopers. And, you know, everyone, this just this totally accepting nature to fandom that really belies the image of the war over the prequels, right? The war over whether they're good movies or not. Doesn't matter. For the most part, people just get along. And I think that's the special thing about Star Wars. It's also the fact that there are just so many entry points, right? You know, maybe everyone should see the original movie, obviously, but there are plenty of people who came to it through Clone Wars.
Sure.
Or I was actually just on tour in Brazil with the legendary Timothy Zahn, which was a wonderful experience. And he pointed out to me that his kids got at Star Wars through Ewoks and droids, you know, the 1985 cartoons. That was where they first encountered it. So, you know, there's many entry points. I mean, and you could say the same of Tolkien, right? You know, you could either read The Hobbit first or read Lord of the Rings, or maybe you're really strange and you came to through the Silmarillion or something like that.
But, or you watched the Rankin Bass animated movies.
Yeah. But it's not quite the same thing. I mean, you really have to have read Lord of the Rings or seen all long Lord of the Rings movies. It's like, you know, if you're a Tolkien fan and you've only read The Hobbit, it's not quite the same as if you're a Star Wars fan and you've only seen Star Wars.
That's so true. That is so true. And that, I think that is a big distinctive aspect that you really have to account for when you talk about the phenomenon of why there aren't Tolkien celebrations and there are Star Wars celebrations.
Narnia, I love the Narnia books, but you kind of have to have read all of them mostly, maybe at least three or four, right, to get the whole story. And Star Wars is just so welcoming in the sense of you watch one episode and you pretty much got the whole notion. I mean, a lot of people talk about how The Force Awakens is, well, they use the dreaded word remake, right? But they're noticing the echoes and callbacks. Let's say that's actually what they're trying to say. And that's deliberate. That's because every Star Wars movie has that. Even the Clone Wars have echoes and callbacks. There's just a certain style to it. It is the hero's journey told over and over again. So it's, you know, that is an advantage in that it's really easy to spread that to a large number of people very fast.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that if you're in touch with that that aspect of it, it really does, I think, only make it more and more of a I guess visceral experience as a Star Wars fan. And I think and you kind of touched on it briefly. I think this is something that I've wanted to ask you for a while, but like if you were to condense and boil down your thoughts onto what exactly is, as someone who's really done a lot of research on all of George Lucas's strengths and weaknesses and his involvement with the original films, what is George Lucas's role as the creator of Star Wars? Like, if someone asked that question, I feel like that's something that's been much debated. It's something that's people feel very differently about depending on who you ask. But like, what's Chris Taylor's perspective on it?
Well, the way that I always put it, you know, after looking into his life and especially looking at all of the interviews he's done and how his story has changed, you know, you have to look at what the constants are in his story. And the biggest constant is that it started with Flash Gordon. And that's the reason why I call Star Wars Flash Gordon fan fiction. Because that's really how it started. Just as, you know, 50 Shades of Grey started off as Twilight fan fiction. We all know that story. You know, Star Wars was very much created because George couldn't get the rights to do Flash Gordon. And then in so doing, or in so not doing, he realized that he actually didn't want to remake Flash Gordon because he wasn't a fan of Emperor Ming and, you know, the sort of racial overtones that the Flash Gordon comic had. So, you know, he just started afresh. And if you look at those first few pages he wrote of the Journal of the Wills and Mace Windy and all of that, you really get that fan fiction feel.
Well, and what's interesting, because like when I hear you say that, I think I understand where you're coming from. What I think, what's a listener to this podcast right now, that can it can sound a little irreverent, right? Because because Star Wars is something that we all hold so dearly. Of it had very modest pop beginnings that I think it's important to recognize that as
it's important
a strength.
To recognize that, and especially because that explains how George treated it, and you know, Dave Filoni tells the story about how, you know, that he and George were talking Clone Wars, and, you know, I forget what it was. I don't even know if he revealed what they were actually talking about, but it was some sort of crucial canonical aspect of the Clone Wars, right? And George is just sort of sitting there sketching it out, I believe literally on the back of a napkin. and he just, you know, Filoni talks about his amazement that this guy was just, you know, treating it kind of irreverently in a way. You just say, oh yeah, we can do this, and oh yeah, we'll invent this character, and we'll say that this thing is canon. And you know, Filoni talks about that moment as his revelation that, well, of course he treats it like that. You know, that's how he's treated the whole thing all along. It's his creation. It's hard to be reverential about yourself. Right.
I think that's
your own works.
No, absolutely. And I think that's still a point of maybe confusion, maybe even contention. That's evident in George Lucas's Oprah interview from a couple years back when he talked about, like, I'll never get to see Star Wars. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that and it really being a moment where I began to understand George Lucas as a creator that made me sympathetic to both his critics and sympathetic to him as a creative genius at the same time. It's kind of weird how that works. And even, you know, the news this week of George Lucas, I mean, it's new, but it's old, you know. All of this has happened before and all of it will happen again. But we have a man who, I wouldn't use the word tortured, but as a creator, I think it's a very bittersweet moment for him. And you see a moment of white, of honest, I'm tipping myself, of raw honesty when he kind of characterizes, and of course, walked back on another phrase of basically selling his children into slavery is kind of the comparison he used. And I think, if you watch it in its full context, it's something that he's meaning, I think, somewhat in jest as a way of using hyperbole to characterize his emotions in the moment. Of course, it makes a great headline.
90% of what George says is actually in jest. I mean, people take him way too seriously.
This is true. This is true. But it is, it's so true. It's like this moment that, of course, it makes great blog headlines. But yeah, I guess even today, looking at, I guess we'll transition a little bit into The Force Awakens, we see a Star Wars that doesn't really have, it has the ghost of George Lucas past influence on it, but I don't think it really has the actual fingerprints of George Lucas as, say, the Clone Wars did and many other recent projects.
Yeah, and I think George was always going to have a hard time with The Force Awakens, to be honest, because he is, you know... And I think he would cop to this as well. He's a control freak. You know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It did produce the sort of the level of perfectionism that he has. So, he sketches his ideas out in the back of a napkin, but then he is, so vigorous in defending what the original vision that he sketched out was. And you can see that in his Star Wars process. You know, he writes the scripts really fast, and then just rewrites them and rewrites them and rewrites them. It was a technique he learned on the first movie. The faster he goes, the better it is. He's always going to be sort of self-doubting about it, so you might as well just do it really fast.
Let's be honest, George Lucas kind of writes a Star Wars script like I write my college papers.
Yeah, exactly. It was what I used to call in at college in England essay crisis night. You know, that one night when you just stay up all night once a week and, fuel yourself with coffee. And after a while, you just get into the habit of doing that. And George completely got into the habit of doing that. It's how he wrote the prequels. He just write these drafts really fast, but not really be satisfied until about 3 days before filming began. When he finally let someone else look at the script he's created. But at the same time, he's sort of really kind of, almost doesn't care about, that's not fair. It's not that he doesn't care about the details when he's writing it. It's that he's more spontaneous about it. I mean, you think of the brilliant Sifo Dyas anecdote, the fact that that character's name was originally supposed to be Sido Dyas, kind of an obvious reference to Sidious, right? And he thought, well, maybe that's too obvious. Maybe they won't hear it. Maybe they won't get it. But then his secretary makes a misprint in typing up his almost illegible, pencil on paper notes.
Yes, what he's so famous for.
Yeah, and then Sifo Dyas is born, and he just sort of runs with it. And, it's the just sort of running it with it, with whatever ends up on paper that I think is where he's sort of loose, plays fast and loose. But then it's like once it's on paper, that is going to be filmed, to within an inch of its life, and he's going to defend that vision. And he's always, he made this reference to selling his children into slavery, but he's always referred to his movies as his children. And right back to THX-1138 and American Graffiti, both of which were edited by the studios after George had turned them in. And he, right from the beginning, made the analogy that the studios were, chopping off a finger from his children, and they're saying it won't hurt. And he's like, but they're my kids, So he's had that analogy his whole life. I think that's the context you need for that joke.
Yeah, that's true. And that's not like he was said that in 2004. No, he was saying that way back in the 70s.
Exactly. So, so there's that. And also, for a control freak who considers Star Wars to be his child, I think seeing someone else's version of it is always going to be hard.
Absolutely.
He had a terrible time on Empire Strikes Back, which is, up until now, the Star Wars movie over which he had the least influence over filming, right? With Return of the Jedi, he was basically, lead director, and Mark Wand was less in charge than it might appear. So, that was really his film in a lot of ways. But, the fact that he had so much respect for Irvin Kershner on Empire You know, and really said that he was going to see the running of that movie, made it really hard for him and his inner control freak. So the idea that someone is taking your child and you know, twisting it in ways that you're not authorized, that's, yeah, I don't imagine that there's any universe in which George Lucas had an easy time with The Force Awakens.
Well, exactly. And I think what's interesting is, as someone who's a huge... is of course, a lot of this has been a process that's actually like chronicled on this podcast of my, it's most obvious when you listen back as my order of favorite Star Wars film has shifted over the years, since seeing the prequel and since seeing the prequels before and then during high school. And what's so funny about it is that as I've kind of, matured, I have a very distinct appreciation for George Lucas's visual storytelling and his the sort of language that he uses to tell his stories, and I have a very distinct appreciation for his creative mind. I think as I've gotten older, and it's on this podcast, I think become, as Empire slowly rose up through the ranks and is now my favorite film, I have even more of an appreciation for the importance of characterization and dialogue and the characters that you have to fall in love with to an extent that is missing a little bit from the prequels. And that's as someone who is kind of, I consider myself a big defender of the prequels, at least in their contribution to the mythology, in a unique and entertaining way that introduced me to Star Wars. So I don't think that can be undersold, but at the same time, we have to be honest, when we look at The Force Awakens today, and I just got out of my fifth screening with some family members who hadn't seen it yet yesterday. Oh, and nice. The first time I watched it, there's a lot of what I would consider jarring in terms of the language, the visual language of storytelling that J.J. Abrams used. It's very distinct from Star Wars. So what's fascinating to me as the conversation about this film has continued is there's been a narrative that's formed that maybe points fingers at, either positively or mostly negatively, at the similarities between plot beats and characterization beats and moments throughout the film that very closely parallel parts of the original trilogy. What's funny for me is that as someone who's watched all of these films so many times, for me, I was like, wow, this is a really different, I mean, it's kind of hard to get used to it. So, and then of course the big kind of prevailing complaint seems to be the similarities. So I think, yeah. What's your perspective on, now that we're kind of in the midst of The Force Awakens whirlwind, Chris, give us your perspective on kind of what this film, what makes this film distinct, maybe, instead of what makes it so similar? Because that's what we've kind of all talked about at length so far.
I think you put your finger on it, that the more familiar you are with Star Wars, the more of a different movie this is. Yes. And also, I think that the more that you see it, the more different it is. I think, you know, the first screening of The Force Awakens for any Star Wars fan is difficult because you're sitting there on the edge of your seat, kind of almost leaning into the screen. Certainly I was down there at the world premiere, you know, and it was big fancy affair, but I was still sort of on the edge of my seat, kind of, you know, in my head going, don't screw it up. You know, and you're just sort of willing the whole thing to be good. You know, you're really sort of involved in it in that way. And then the second time, you know exactly what's going to happen. So you can just relax and watch, you know, enjoy the details, immerse yourself in this universe, and you're just sort of, there's this pleasant feeling that washes over you. Oh, I'm gonna spend another couple of hours in the GFFA, you know. And it's great. You just relax and immerse. And I wrote an article because I was so annoyed with the number of people who say that this is just a retread, it's a remake. And I sort of know what they're talking about, because I sort of had some of those feelings the first time around, but I don't think that anyone saying that has seen it twice. You know, the more you examine it, the more it falls apart.
Well, let's talk. You know, all right. Let's talk about it for a second, because you are prepared. You are armed with perspective on this, that you've thought it through well. But I think like the most telling difference is that the mentor dies right in the middle of the third act. Like, that is not something we've ever seen in Star Wars. We're used to getting at least some sort of celebratory release and that there's some sense of triumph and sacrifice. And here, it's just like, all right, Han Solo died, and we really don't fully appreciate why. And it's a tragedy on a level that it wasn't the case with Qui-Gon, certainly wasn't the case with Obi-Wan. There's a sense of finality and willingness. But with this film, it's just like hopes just dashed with the manufacturer of this unwieldy and raw evil lightsaber, represented by the sort of unwieldy and raw plot twist that this serves. So while there's the comparison you can make with either the Phantom Menace or, of course, especially A New Hope, that most people are, when it comes to this sacrifice, it's incredibly different.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how they could have made it more different than... I think what people are comparing it to is the death of Obi-Wan, which happens roughly around the same point in New Hope. But so what? You know, it's an entirely different character. He dies in an entirely different way. He doesn't want to die, whereas Obi-Wan is sort of resigned to his death.
Mm-hmm.
Han just wants to bring his son home. And, you know, really, the more you examine it, the more this notion that it's a retread completely falls apart. I mean, yes, Han is now a believer in the Jedi and the Force, but that doesn't really make him a mentor in the same way that Obi-Wan was. You know, and he sort of haltingly tries to offer Rey a job or says he's thinking about it. But he's just sort of, you know, he's still cranky old Han. You know, he's the guy we know and love. And, you know, has obviously made some mistakes and... is trying to put it right and trying to put things right with Leia. Yeah, you know, it does make me angry sometimes when people say it's just another Obi-Wan situation.
Yeah, but you know, I think what's interesting is that I feel like even remix is a bit too strong of a word. There are a lot of really fun, familiar elements in the film. But also a lot of really unfamiliar elements. And so, like, when you see a giant tracking shot of the X-Wing, you can compare that to the giant tracking shot, of the opening of Revenge of the Sith. But it's extremely different because it's a stationary or almost stationary camera shot. So while I'm getting kind of into the weeds in terms of detail, you have shots like that. You have the ending of the film. Is done from a Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson style helicopter drone shot of Luke Skywalker. Like, there's a lot that's so unfamiliar that it takes a lot of getting used to for someone who's definitely a huge student, I guess, of the George Lucas form of storytelling. Yeah. But upon
it ends on a cliffhanger.
Which
Star Wars has never really done before. You know, you could say that the Empire Strikes Back ending is sort of a cliffhanger because nothing's resolved, but it's a bit more. You know, we've reached a point of where we're satisfied, right? We see that Lando and Chewie are going off in the Falcon, and we see that Luke and Leia are, you know, at the medical ship, waving them off, basically.
I'm going to totally see. I feel that again, my poor Homo sapien brain can't quite function to the point that I wish it would. But there's this incredible podcast. I think I've mentioned it briefly on the show, but it's the Story Wonk Star Wars podcast. Mm-hmm. And the host has a great episode on Empire Strikes Back, talking about it really isn't, at least from the classic sense of storytelling, a cliffhanger. And of course, he has a brilliant writer's term for the way it ends that, of course, I can't remember. But suffice to say, there is a sense of tension left with the film, but there's no immediate plot that we just don't know what's going to happen. And in the case of The Force Awakens, we honestly don't have a appreciation for how or why Kylo Ren got to the point where he can run his father through his chest with a lightsaber. We have hints, but that, I think, is the central, it's a plot point that we have to know, I think, to understand Han's death. And as someone who grew up absolutely in love with the character of Han Solo, to justify his sacrifice to an extent that I feel, or at least I hope as a fan, that it does.
Yeah, and obviously we're going to find out much more about Kylo Ren. You know, we have the foreshadowing of his training at the hands of Snoke, which I would imagine will take up at least a portion of of episode 8. In fact, you know, you could look at episode, I mean, episode 7 is sort of like the two heroes' journeys, right? The two beginnings of the heroes' journeys for both Rey and Finn. Episode 8, I would imagine, is going to be the two trainings. The training of Kylo Ren and the training of Rey. You know, they may be in progress as we meet them again, but that's really the next part of the story here. I just really want a
Rocky style training montage, please, for Kylo Ren.
I'd love that, a Star Wars training montage.
Oh my goodness, Chris! Wow, this has been an absolutely incredible episode, and far better than I could have possibly hoped for. Thanks so much for coming on to the program and offering your insights, right? and giving me a copy of a book that I promise I will get my hands on at some point.
You know, just put that dust jacket on another book.
You know, just pretend.
Stick it on your shelf and. No, but also, you know, the paperback. It's good to get a copy of the paperback. I think I gave you the hardback.
Yes, because I got I was unaware of it, but in some of the Christmas presents I purchased and I got a couple copies. There's some awesome added material on the paperback edition.
Yeah, well, when I wrote the hardback, we didn't even know the name The Force Awakens. We didn't know the names of anyone who was appearing in it.
That's right.
And this is my vision for the book. That it was, you know, that I will always update it. Every time we get a new Star Wars movie, you know, I will add a new chapter. Now, I don't know how long my publisher is going to let me keep doing that, but that's definitely the vision going forward. So, yeah, there's an extra chapter on The Force Awakens. I talked to Jason Ward, Making Star Wars, about how he got all those spoilers. You know, the fan reaction to the trailers is in there. So, yeah, new information.
That is awesome, awesome. The book is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. If you have not read it, what are you doing? Go buy it right now. You get the paperback with the awesome bonus content, or if you're an audio guy like me, you can go to audibletrial.com/StarWarsReport and get it for free. So, it's been an amazing time. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. And where can folks find you?
They best to find me on Twitter at FutureBoy. And go to Mashable.com for all my latest writings and many, many more.
Awesome sauce, man. Yeah, at Future Boy, be sure to follow. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Star Wars Report. I'm on Twitter as well. It's at The Riley Guy, R-I-L-E-Y. That's the same for Instagram, Snapchat, all that good stuff. Also, make sure you email us at StarWarsReport@gmail.com. And also, you can keep track of everything we're doing at StarWarsReport.com. Finally, if you've enjoyed this program, there are two things that you can do if you want to support us. You can toss in a few coins over at Patreon.com/StarWarsReport and support the show there. We really do appreciate everyone who's come on board there in the recent months and really helped take the show to the next level and help us with our equipment woes and hosting costs and all that cost that comes along with doing this show for you guys. So we appreciate all of you supporting us there. And, of course, appreciate everyone who's gone in and in the future will go in to StarWarsReport.com/iTunes and go straight through that link and head to the iTunes store and leave us a review. We thank everyone who's done that, and it really does help the show. So we appreciate you tuning in. That's going to do it for this episode of the Star Wars Report podcast. Until next time, may the Force be with you, and remember, many Bothans died to bring you this podcast. Oh, man. Chris, thanks so much. This was an absolute blast.
Yeah, I had fun. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
All right. That's awesome, man. Well, I'm crazy because I'm doing a ton of...